Blog Talk Radio.
I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. Then you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy.
I wanted the fame, but not the cover of Newsweek. Oh well, guess beggars can't be choosy. Wanted to receive attention from my music. Wanted to be left alone in public, excuse me. But wanting my cake and eat it too. And wanting it both ways, fame made me a balloon. Cause my ego inflated when I blew sleep. It was confusing, cause all I wanted to do was be the Bruce Lee of loosely abused ink. Use it as a tool when I blew steam. Woo! Hit the lottery, ooh wee. But with what I gave up to get, it was bittersweet. It was like winning a used me. I'm running cause I think I'm getting so huge I need a shrink. I'm beginning to lose sleep. One sheep, two sheep, going cuckoo and kooky is cool key. But I'm actually weirder than you think. Cause
I'm friends with the monster.
Of a poet, but I know somebody once told me to seize the moment and don't squander it, cause you never know when it all could be over tomorrow, so I keep conjuring.
Sometimes I wonder where these thoughts come from.
Yeah, ponder it, do you wonder? There's no wonder you're losing your mind the way it wanders.
I think you've been wandering off down yonder and stumbled on to Jeff Van Bondren. Cause I need an interventionist to intervene between me and this monster and save me from myself and all this conflict. Cause of everything that I love killing me and I can't conquer it. My OCD talking me in the head, keep knocking. Nobody's home, I'm sleepwalking. I'm just relaying what the voice in my head saying. Don't shoot the messenger, I'm just
friends with
the
monster.
One day that I walk amongst you a regular civilian, but until then Trump get killed and I'm coming straight at MC's blood gets spilled and I'm taking back to the days that I get on a Dre track, give every kid who got played that bump the feeling and shit to say back to the kids who played them. I ain't here to save the fucking children, but if one kid out of 100 million who are going through a struggle feels it and relates that, great, it's payback. Russell Wilson falling way back in the draft, turn nothing into something, still can make that draw in the gold dump. I will spin Rumpelstiltskin in a haystack. Maybe I need a straight jacket, face facts, I am nuts for real, but I'm okay with that. It's nothing, I'm still
friends with the monster that's under my bed. Get along with the voices inside of my head. You're trying to save me, stop holding your breath. And you think I'm crazy, yeah, you think I'm crazy. I'm friends with the monster that's under my bed.
Get along with
the voices inside of my head.
What we're going to do right now is let y'all listen to the Stone Cold podcast with Paul Heyman. If there's like any time left, we're going to talk about wrestling and probably some personal things about something that got to do with last night and tonight on Raw and stuff like that. So what we're going to do, we're going to let you listen to the podcast. If there's any time left, we're going to talk about what we need to talk about tonight.
I think it should be. I feel like that would bring more spontaneity. I don't know what's happening next. If you see a guy out there, sometimes you fall on your face, but you learn from it, and it makes you stronger. Talk to me about the art and science of a promo. Well, I think in today's environment, the question to ask is, where's the money? And that goes back to a lesson that I learned from Dusty Rhodes again. I mean, this is, we had some kind of special. I don't remember which show it was, but it was when I was first in WCW. I think we were probably maybe heading into Starrcade. My very first Starrcade, I was just starting WCW. And this is where there's Ric Flair, and there's Dusty Rhodes, and there's Sting, and there's Kevin Sullivan, and there's the Road Warriors. I mean, man, you just talk about just a lineup full of guys that could really cut promos,
right,
especially in that era. And there's Jim Cornette, and I was opposed to Jim Cornette. And Cornette had his promo somewhere in the middle of the show, and I thought I was going to have the next segment, and Dusty switched it. I didn't follow Cornette. Dusty said, "You won't close the show, baby." You know, "Okay, Dream, how much time do I have?" And he goes, "As much time as left, you're going to just get a 5-second countdown and wrap it up."
Yeah.
Wow, so it was open. You know, just the last match is in the ring, and I could have had 4 minutes. I could have had 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just wing it, you know. And I went out there, and I had about 4 minutes. And I did everything. I imitated everybody on the roster. I talked about everybody else's match. I tried to put everything over. I ran around the podium. I did everything I possibly could except speaking in tongues to garner people's attention so that you wouldn't dare click that dial. And, you know, and I ended it with some ridiculous punchline that, you know, so they know that people said, "Oh, that was very cute what you said." And I came in the back, and I thought, man, I'm a star. I'm Paulie Danielson. I'm the greatest promo of all time. And Dusty looks at me and goes, "Thank you very much, kid. That was so very, very entertaining. But the question I have for you is, where's the money?"
Right.
I never sold Starrcade.
You went out there and you danced around for 4 minutes and you said blah, 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 blah. But at the end of the day, there wasn't no money in that promo.
I drew no money.
Right.
And I never forgot that. So I think that, you know, old school is new school, just updated into today's environment. And I think that the one thing you have to think of in everything that you say is, well, where's the money in this? What am I selling?
Right.
Now, sometimes that's all you sell is personality.
Right.
You know, a promo for me sometimes is simply to say, Brock Lesnar. And just by the fact that I say his name viscerally and violently and with, you know, in that gutter way, people
right.
go, "Ooh, it's Brock Lesnar." It's not Brock Lesnar.
Oh, man, it evokes him, and I'm scared of this stuff.
And I mean, I did a whole summer's worth of promos last year just saying my client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the Undertaker's undefeated streak at WrestleMania. That was my one line all summer long, because that's what I was in charge of selling. Now, if I'm in charge of selling the main event of SummerSlam or the main event of WrestleMania, what else am I going to say? So that's how I approach it, and that's how people today have to approach it, is what am I selling here?
But when you was a kid, you were flipping channels on TV,
right.
Yes, it was Madison Square Garden, it was Vince McMahon Jr.,
right.
Vince, yeah. And the yeah. back over, wherever you ask, Vince, he was interviewing superstar Billy Graham at
right.
Madison Square Garden.
Right.
And Billy Graham was wearing that maroon Arizona State shirt. And that's what hooked you on the business.
Yeah.
So when I think about, you know, some of the technicalities of a promo, you know, I think, you know, content, you know, delivery, intensity, cadence, you know, volume, or just the different components. So there's many things. I mean, so many times, here's the thing. A lot of people didn't like the Ultimate Warriors promos. I did. Because they were an endorsement of his character. When he's talking about, you know, fueling up spaceships and sending them to the moon and all this stuff, I dug it because it furthered, you know, my belief in the warrior. He was being true to the warrior. You know, he wasn't, you know, talking about how bad he was going to crush you and tear you to pieces.
Right.
He was further embracing his character. So I dug warrior's promos, but a lot of people didn't. So it's and sometimes it's not always just about content. You know, it's about how you say it.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, because you could go out and say a lot of the stuff that you're saying, but wouldn't resonate with me or anybody else, but it's the way with which you do that. And all of those different components play in, but to your point, sometimes there's times to lay, you know, different factors or all of it on the line.
Right.
And sometimes
I agree.
jump on a soapbox here. On the other side of that, just because you have a guy that can cut a promo doesn't mean that he should go out there and get 5 minutes every single Monday night if he doesn't have anything to bounce that off or someone to echo the reverse sentiments, because that's giving a guy enough verbal rope to hang himself.
Right, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
No. So in your thought process, I mean, with what's going on, how would we change the promo system? You're a guy, you know, working with Brock Lesnar, but how influential are you with guys and gals coming up in the system? Because you gave me confidence. You were able to, you know, turn me into a laser beam, and you have a lot of guys. Do you work with any of the talent on that?
I mean, I talk to as many of the young talent that want to come up to me and talk with me about it. I don't impose my opinions on them. And
I know you got a lot of people beating down your door because everybody thinks highly of you, and you won't say that, but I will. So it's got to be a long list.
The one thing that I will say that I look at today's promos and I think where there's a disconnect is that people will come into the ring and pontificate right off the bat.
Right.
You know, they just take the mic, and it's automatically, last week on SmackDown, I got very annoyed by what happened to me. It's like, whoa, hold on a second. You know, and that's where, by the way, I came up with, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Paul Heyman. Because it's the very first thing I say. I engage.
Right.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Paul Heyman. People go, oh, you know who that is? That's Paul Heyman. You know, and I am the advocate for Brock Lesnar. Oh, so now I know who you are. You're Paul Heyman. And I know what you do. You're that guy's advocate.
Right.
And I'm here tonight to sell you on SummerSlam, on WrestleMania, on Brock's rivalry with Seth Rollins, The Undertaker, or whomever. Oh, so this is the purpose of this guy's interview. So in three sentences, I've now told you who I am, what I do, and what I'm here for tonight. I've now engaged in the audience. I'm Paul Heyman. I'm Bob. I'm Brock Lesnar's advocate. I'm a truck driver. I'm a lawyer. I'm a doctor. And I'm here tonight to tell you about this. Oh, I'm here tonight to listen to you. So I engage. And I think that we have lost the art of engaging the audience, and we are preaching and pontificating to the audience.
And sometimes just simply stating words or orating, trying to deliver a message, but if that message is not heartfelt, it does not resonate.
Right.
And it just comes from nowhere. One thing I just want to touch on before I move along, when I'm seeing two guys out there doing promos, and both guys got a stick in their hands, and the other guy's talking, and then the guy's got the stick down by his side, and he starts mouthing while the other guy's talking. Well, if you get a mouth, pick up the horn and speak your piece, or don't move your mouth,
right?
Because you're burying yourself. So that's just kind of a green thing that a lot of guys do. It doesn't make sense. A lot of veteran guys will do it. You've been here for a long time, but you hustled your way in, and your first hustle, indeed, was with Vince's dad.
Right.
And so how well did you know Vince Sr.?
Well, I mean, I made my first $50 in this business from Vince Sr. I actually took that picture. whoever got this, congratulations. I actually took that picture. I believe that is the one with... It's either with Monsoon or with Tony. I think it's with Tony Atlas, which is why they cropped out Tony Atlas. Because I wasn't going to tell a Tony Atlas story on here. I met Vincent James McMahon because, and I've told this story several times, I found out that he used to take everybody, his inner circle, Arnold Skolin, Gorilla Monsoon, Angelo Savoldi, Willie Gildenberg. I took that picture too. In fact, that's the picture. That's the picture that got me the $50 of Vince and Andre. What happened was, anyway, I found that they used to take his inner circle to Ben Benson's restaurant in New York City. And I called the Cape Cod Coliseum, which is where the offices were, because the Cape Cod Coliseum at the time was owned by Vincent Kennedy McMahon. But that's where the Capital Wrestling Corporation offices were now located. Vince Sr. lived in Boca. So I called, and I had a deep, when I was 14 years old, I had a deep voice. And I said, this is Paul Heyman. I met Vince McMahon at Ben Benson Steakhouse. And he told me to call him to get my press pass. And after a number of different people, screeners, I got past. I ended up on the phone with Vincent James McMahon.
Right.
And I was told to go down to the Holland Hotel on 42nd Street, 8th Avenue, which at the time was in the pre-Giuliani era. So the worst part of New York City. And I went up to the second floor, and there's Gorilla Monsoon and Arnold Skolin with playing Pinochle with an open bottle of booze and two big glasses of ice, and I got my press pass. And I went into Madison Square Garden, and I hung out in the photographer's room. And what I did was I knew I had to get out to the ring and stay out of sight, out of mind. So back then, before the digital era, I had 400 ASA film, which is such a fast film, you didn't need a flash for it. And I'm walking down the hallway in Madison Square Garden, and Vince Sr. is talking to Andre. And a photographer, George Napolitano and Bill Apter, wanted to take their picture. And as I'm walking by, I keep the camera low, and I focus. And I took the picture from below, which made Andre just look like such a giant, called, you know, the old Andre side. And here's Vince Senior looking up with, you know, and he was the Pope of Madison Square Garden. And he's looking up majestically at Andre. So I come back the next month, and I printed out an 8x10 of the picture. And I'm in the hallway, and I watch, and I see my opening. And as soon as Vince Sr. is alone, I make a beeline for him, and I put the picture in his hand.
Yeah.
And two Madison Square Garden security guards, including one named Emil, and I know right now, if Vince is listening to this, there's a tear running down his face because that was... I hope it was... Oh, God, if I have his name wrong, I know Vince is going to go on. I'm going to kill Heyman when this is over. And it was Emil Dallin, because he was a big former New York City cop.
Right.
And then the Garden was his turf. And they picked me up by the elbows, and they pushed me back against the wall and go, "You're not supposed to go up to him." I'm like, I got a press pass. And did you get him a picture? Yeah, I gave him a picture. And he had his hand. Next thing he hears, "Young man, may I speak to you for a minute?" And
Senior said that.
No. And the guy goes inside, and it's Howard Finkel.
Yeah.
"Young man, did you take that picture?" I said, "Yes, sir, I did." And he goes, "Mr. McMahon likes that picture very much." I said, "Well, it's his. He can have it, you know. Thank you very much." And there's a folded up $50 bill, and he presses it in my hand like this, and he says, "That's for your troubles. Every month, please give us whatever picture we'd like to use it for, a program, a poster, something, if you don't mind, and we'd like to cover your trans."
So Howard
greets me to the Garden. Well, no, the old man greets me through Howard.
That's great.
And I never got the $50 direct from Vince Senior.
Right.
I get it from Arnold Skolin. I got it from Benny Skolin.
Right.
But I never got it direct from Vince Senior.
What was the difference between Vince Senior's vision of the business and where it was to what Vince has done with the business?
Well, I mean, it was different times. I mean, Vince Sr. played to the distribution of the times, which was syndicated television, in which your tapes were bicycled from station to station to station to station, and he had a carved-out territory that was his. And if someone, even if it's the White Sox owner, Eddie Einhorn, who was a billionaire in the 1970s, tried to come into the territory, you fought for the turf and you fought for the territory, and that was his section of the country.
Right.
From, you know, Presque Isle, Maine, all the way down to Washington, D.C. And then below that were the Crockett's, and Eddie Graham had Florida, and Jim Barnett and a number of different partners would have Georgia, and there were the Von Erichs in Texas, and blah, blah, blah,
right.
blah, blah. When the times were changing with the advent of cable television, Joe Blanchard, from right here in San Antonio, Texas, was the first person to cut a deal on USA Network. Ole Anderson from Georgia was already going up into Columbus, Ohio, and taking a look at expanding into there. So the roots of expansion and testing the different parameters were already out there, because Ole, actually, Superstation PBS was already a superstation. If you had early cable, they were on first. They were on, you know, national TV for whatever limited penetration cable TV had. So when Vincent Tempe McMahon bought the promotion from his father, he was walking into a far different distribution era, because now we were coming into the advent of true national cable television, which was going to wipe out the concept of syndicating your television show to a selected territory, because now the territory was the whole country.
But that was starting when Senior had the business, but he was loyal to the territory system, correct? Or not?
Well, here's the question that I think, no one ever back then was willing to ask. If Vincent James McMahon was 5 years younger, would he have honored those territorial boundaries for what he also had seen what was going to happen with the with national cable distribution, and understood that if he didn't get into it, Jim Barnett was going to do it. Jim Crockett was going to try. Bill Watts had his eye on, especially with Jim Ross in his ear. Vern Gagne, for as far behind the times as Vern Gagne was, Vern would have understood that.
Right.
Vern would have understood national cable television. Whoever could get to him, and he did because he went on ESPN. So someone was going to get in, and who got there first was Joe Blanchard. But if Vincent James McMahon ran the promotion 5 years longer, I think he would have had no choice but to go down that road and to take everybody else on. Now, was he equipped to do it? Was he ruthless enough to do it?
Right.
Was he aggressive and assertive? And was he ambitious enough to do it? I didn't know him well enough.
Okay, then, and obviously, this. Oh, Vincent Kennedy McMahon, so what? What if Vincent was aggressive enough and had the balls to go down that road?
Yes.
Vincent told me, he would get death threats back in the day.
Did
you hear those stories?
A lot of people hated him. Oh, yeah. I witnessed every month Lou Albano wanting to kill him. Lou Albano got fired more times than anybody else in the history of WWF, WWF, WWE, all the different. Well, because he was choked in Madison Square. This was a monthly thing. If you got to the Garden early, Lou Albano would show up. The Garden show began at 8:30 back then,
right.
on Mondays, every once a month, Madison Square Garden, 8:30 at night on a Monday. And Lou Albano would show up probably at 4 o'clock in the afternoon with a huge bottle of Tropicana grapefruit juice. And look at that picture. That's me at 15 years old, Ernie Roth, the Grand Wizard, Lou Albano, and Freddie Black.
Right.
So... And a big pimple right there on my chin. I just got my braces.
Like
hey, certainly was.
So much to get used to.
Yeah, I'm all right now, but yesterday was rough. So, Albano was snorkel. I mean, he had a 64-ounce bottle of Tropicana grapefruit juice with about a drop of grapefruit juice in it. I mean, he was hammered. And, of course, no matter what they wanted him to do, it's the kid. It's Junior. The kid. That's the stupidest. Oh, he hated him. He hated him because, you know, he was loyal to the old man, and then the kid was too aggressive, and then the kid wanted this, and it's the kid, and Lou just couldn't accept the transition, and he would say something way out of line and way stupid, and he got fired. He would be fired, and he would go down to Charlie O's, and somewhere during before 7 o'clock, Vince Sr. would send somebody. Angelo Sovoldi, Phil Zacco, somebody down, you know, go get Albano, and they'd load him up with coffee, and he'd come back with his tail between his legs. I'm sorry. He had to love him, and they gave his job back.
But what about you and the old man? What about you and Vince? I mean, you guys have had your highs and lows, tumultuous times, good times, bad times.
Right.
Well, where are you guys now?
I think we probably get along better than we ever have before because we don't interact with each other on a daily basis. I'm not really driving him crazy trying to tell him how to save the industry. You know, I pretty much, it's funny, I watched a David Letterman interview with Charlie Rose.
Right.
And it was funny because I really related to it, how when Letterman switched to CBS, how he thought he had all the answers for television. You know, and he said, you know, don't worry about television. We're gonna fix TV. You know, and that was always the dynamic with me and Vince, is that when I came aboard this company in 2001, I was hired to give the contrarian opinion, and so I always thought, well, that's my job. So no matter what he says, here's an alternative. Here's the opposite. And because he always, you know, think as I think, do as I do. You know, okay, so I would fight. Because I would always, you know, I'd say, you know, you're a fighter, you know, you would push your ideas through until you were smacked down. And I guess he got tired of smacking me down. it became a contentious dynamic for many, many years.
But did you finally, after all those years, just change the way you dealt with him?
Oh, of course.
I mean,
I've changed the way I've dealt with a lot of people. I mean, fatherhood has mellowed me out. Except for tonight on this podcast, because I drank 5 iced coffees before we came on the air. We have hosts who drink stone cold beer, and we have the advocating Jew who drinks 5 iced coffees before he does the podcast. I've mellowed tremendous. I mean, you know me back in the day. I was, you know.
No, I was drunk.
I mean, You know, it's funny because, and this is a true story, and I dare anybody to prove me wrong. I mean, I've never, never in my life done a line of cocaine. Never. Never. Oh, my goodness.
Come on.
You know me back in the day. If I had a line of cocaine, my heart would have blown up. Well, again, I grew up in an era where Len Bias did one line of cocaine and he dropped dead. And my thing was always, I always had the fear that I would do a line of cocaine and that my father, and it would blow up my heart, and my father would be standing over my grave and say, "You threw your life away." You know, I could understand you throwing your life away for a lot of things, but this, you make me stand over you. It's a Jewish guilt thing, you know. So no, but nobody who knew me back then, you know, case in point, would ever believe. You were strung up on something. You were wired to the gills. And that's just how I was. I was so high strung back then. Fatherhood has chilled me out tremendously. And it's chilled me out in my approach to what we do. Also here, it used to be I would live and breathe for every single solitary thing that would happen on a show. If I was the lead writer, I would fight Vince and Stephanie to my own death.
Well, let's talk about when you were the head SmackDown writer. It was your mission for SmackDown to take down Raw.
Right.
And it did.
Yeah. Yeah, and that got me.
How much did that get you for succeeding?
I think I realized how much Cena was getting me when I had the announcer, when I had Michael Cole and Taz on the air start calling you Raw the Feet Show. what happened was I was on a plane.
Yeah.
I was on the corporate jet. We were flying back, and I pitched
the plane ride with Vince, right?
Right.
Now this is the infamous plane ride. This is what I've been hearing about. What happened?
Oh no! That was something. That was 2006. The infamous plane ride was
okay. I want to hear about the infamous 2006 plane ride. What happened?
Oh,
did they open it with the cargo doors about to throw you out? What happened?
You know, it's funny. He's never talked about it publicly, and so I don't know if I'm in the right to violate that confidence. Here's what happened, in a nutshell. It was time for me to go. I had lost my passion. I had lost my purpose in the industry. We had revitalized, reignited, resurrected. That's the word I'm looking for. We had resurrected the ECW brand. It was very personal to me.
Yes.
That brand. And I didn't like the way it was going. And it became a very personal fight between me and Vince. I had offered many times, just let me write SmackDown again and give someone else the ECW brand. Because maybe you'll feel less compelled to change the show on someone that's not me. It just became a bad dynamic. Now, you know, it was the old cowboy thing. He's certainly big enough for the two. And one of them had to go. And I would dare to say that in a situation where you or Vince McMahon have to go from the company, it ain't going to be Vince that's leaving. So my run was over. It really was. I was burned out. I was tired. I had lost my love for it, and I couldn't find my way anymore. And he sensed it, and he was angry at me, and I was angry at him, which is just a toxic working relationship. And it came to a head. We had a really, 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 really indescribably bad show, and we were looking at each other and messing each other because it's like, this is what you did to my brand. And he's like, this is what you did to my investment. And it all came to a head on the plane, and by the time they got off that plane, he really, really, really wanted me to go home, and I was really, really happy to oblige. And it took 5.5 years for that to become a real learning lesson for the both of us.
I got to get to a couple of stories on the road, because I think we have 10, 15 minutes left on the podcast. Man, back in the day, we get on the road, a bunch of guys in the car, and we put the territory.
You guys have a good night. Enjoy the weekend. We listen to us this Thursday for Clapback. Good night, everybody.